The best hope that remains is to try and salvage something with a peace. That is all I meant to do. Gods be good, how can they call it treason? Davos stood frowning. My lord, what did you do? Not treason. Never treason. I love his grace as much as any man. My own niece is his queen, and I remain loyal to him when wiser men fled. I am his hand, the hand of the king. How can I be a traitor? I only meant to save our lives and honour. Yes. He licked his lips. I penned a letter. Salador-san swore that he had a man who could get it to King's Landing to Lord Tywin. His lordship is a man of reason, and my terms, the terms were fair, more than fair.
What terms were these, my lord?
It is filthy here, Lord Alistair said suddenly, and that odour, what is that odour?
A pale, said Davos, gesturing. We have no privy here. What terms?
His lordship stared at the pale in horror.
That Lord Stannis give up his claim to the Iron Throne and retract all he said of Joffrey's bastardy, on the condition that he be accepted back into the King's peace and confirmed as Lord of Dragonstone and Storm's End. I vow to do the same for the return of Brightwater Keep and all our lands. I thought Lord Tywin would see the sense in my proposal. He still has the Starks to deal with, and the Iron Men as well. I offer to seal the bargain by wedding Shireen to Joffrey's brother Tommen.
He shook his head.
The terms, they were as good as we are ever like to get. Even you can see that, surely.
Yes, said Davos. Even me.
Unless Tannis should father a son, such a marriage would mean that Dragonstone and Storm's End would one day pass to Tommen, which would doubtless please Lord Tywin. Meanwhile, the Lannisters would have Shireen as hostage to make certain Stannis raise no new rebellions.
And what did his grace say when you proposed these terms to him?
He's always with the Red Woman, and he's not in his right mind, I fear. This talk of a stone dragon, madness. I tell you, sheer madness. Did we learn nothing from Arian Brightfire? From the Nine Majors, from the Alchemists, did we learn nothing from Summer Hall? No good has ever come from these dreams of dragons. I told Axel as much. My way was better, surer, and Stannis gave me his seal. He gave me leave to rule. The hand speaks with the king's voice.
Not in this.
Davos was no courtier, and he did not even try to blunt his words.
It is not in Stannis to yield, so long as he knows his claim is just. No more than he can unsay his words against Joffrey when he believes them true. As for the marriage, Tommen was born of the same incest as Joffrey, and his grace would sooner see Shireen dead than wed to such.
A vein throbbed in Florence's forehead.
He has no choice.
Oh, you are wrong, my lord. He can choose to die a king.
And us with him? Is that what you desire, Onion Knight?
No, but I am the king's man, and I will make no peace without his leave.
Lord Alistair stared at him helplessly for a long moment, and then began to weep. Eddard.
Lord Arryn's death was a great sadness for all of us, my lord, Grandmaster Pycelle said. I would be more than happy to tell you what I can of the manner of his passing. Do be seated. Would you care for refreshments? Some dates, perhaps? I have some very fine persimmons as well. Wine no longer agrees with my digestion, I fear. But I can offer you a cup of iced milk, sweetened with honey. I find it most refreshing in this heat.
There was no denying the heat. Ned could feel the silk tunic clinging to his chest.
Thick, moist air covered the city like a damp woolen blanket, and the riverside had grown unruly as the poor fled their hot, airless warrens to jostle for sleeping places near the water, where the only breath of wind was to be found. "That would be most kind," Ned said, seating himself. Picel lifted a tiny silver bell with thumb and forefinger and tinkled it gently. A slender young serving girl hurried into the solar.
"Iced milk for the king's hand and myself, if you would be so kind, child. Well sweetened."
As the girl went to fetch their drinks, the Grand Maester knotted his fingers together and rested his hands on his stomach.
"The small folk say that the last year of summer is always the hottest. It is not so, yet oftentimes it feels that way. Does it not? On days like this, I envy you northerners your summer snows."
The heavy jewel chain around the old man's neck clinked softly as he shifted in his seat.
"To be sure, Kingmaker's summer was hotter than this one, and ne'er as long. There were fools, even in the citadel, who took that to mean that the great summer had come at last, the summer that never ends. But in the seventh year it broke suddenly, and we had a short autumn and a terrible long winter. Still, the heat was fierce while it lasted. Old towns teemed and sweltered by day and came alive only by night. We would walk in the gardens by the river and argue about the gods. I remember the smells of those nights, my lord, perfume and sweat, melons ripe to bursting, peaches and pomegranates, nightshade and moon bloom. I was a young man then, still forging my chain. The heat did not exhaust me as it does now."
Picel's eyes were so heavily lidded he looked half asleep.
"My pardons, Lord Eddard. You did not come to hear foolish meanderings of a summer forgotten before your father was born. Forgive an old man his wanderings, if you would. Minds are like swords, I do fear. The old ones go to rust. And here is our milk."
The serving girl placed the tray between them, and Picel gave her a smile.
"Sweet child."
He lifted a cup, tasted, nodded.
"Thank you. You may go."
When the girl had taken her leave, Picel peered at Ned through pale, rheumy eyes.
"Now, where were we? Oh, yes, you asked about Lord Aaron."
"I did." Ned sipped politely at the iced milk. It was pleasantly cold, but oversweet to his taste.
"If truth be told, the hand had not quite seemed himself for some time," Picel said. "We had sat together on council many a year, he and I, and the signs were there to read, but I put them down to the great burdens he had borne so faithfully for so long. Those broad shoulders were weighed down by all the cares of the realm, and more besides. His son was ever sickly, and his lady wife so anxious that she would scarcely let the boy out of her sight. It was enough to weary even a strong man, and the Lord John was not young. Small wonder if he seemed melancholy and tired, or so I thought at the time. Yet now I am less certain."
He gave a ponderous shake of his head. "What can you tell me of his final illness?" The Grand Maester spread his hands in a gesture of helpless sorrow.
"He came to me one day, asking after a certain book, as hale and healthy as ever, though it did seem to me that something was troubling him deeply. The next morning he was twisted over in pain, too sick to rise from bed. Maester Coleman thought it was a chill on the stomach. The weather had been very hot, and the hand often iced his wine, which can upset the digestion. When Lord John continued to weaken, I went to him myself, but the guards did not grant me the power to save him."
"I have heard that you sent Maester Coleman away." The Grand Maester's nod was a slow and deliberate
as a glacier. I did, and I fear the Lady Lysa will never forgive me that. Maybe I was wrong, but at the time I thought it best. Maester Coleman is like a son to me, and I yield to none in my esteem for his abilities, but he is young, and the young oft-times do not comprehend the frailty of an older body. He was purging Lord Aaron with wasting potions and pepper juice, and I feared he might kill him.
Did Lord Aaron say anything to you during his final hours? Pycelle wrinkled his brow.
In the last stages of his fever, the hand called out the name Robert several times, but whether he was asking for his son or for the king I could not say. Lady Lysa would not permit the boy to enter the sick room for fear that he too might be taken ill. The king did come, and he sat beside the bed for hours, talking and joking of times long past, in hopes of raising Lord John's spirits. His love was fierce to see.
Was there nothing else? No final words?
When I saw that all hope had fled, I gave the hand the milk of the poppy, so he should not suffer. Just before he closed his eyes for the last time, he whispered something to the king and his lady wife, a blessing for his son. "The seed is strong," he said. At the end, his speech was too slurred to comprehend. Death did not come until the next morning, but Lord John was at peace after that. He never spoke again.
Ned took another swallow of milk, trying not to gag on the sweetness of it. Did it seem to you that there was anything unnatural about Lord Aaron's death?
Unnatural?
The aged maester's voice was thin as a whisper.
No, I could not say so. Sad, for a certainty. Yet, in its own way, death is the most natural thing of all, Lord Eddard. John Aaron rests easy now, his burdens lifted at last.
"This illness that took him," said Ned, "have you ever seen its like before in other men?"
Nearly 40 years I have been Grand Maester of the Seven Kingdoms," Pycelle replied. "Under our good King Robert and Aerys Rhaegarion before him, and his father Jaehaerys the Second before him, and even for a few short months under Jaehaerys' father, Aegon the Fortunate, the fifth of his name. I have seen more of illness than I care to remember, my lord. I will tell you this. Every case is different, and every case is alike. Lord John's death was no stranger than any other."
His wife thought otherwise. The Grand Maester nodded.
"I recall now, the widow is sister to your own noble wife. If an old man may be forgiven his blunt speech, let me say that grief can derange even the strongest and most disciplined of minds, and the Lady Lysa was never that. Since her last stillbirth, she has seen enemies in every shadow, and the death of her lord husband left her shattered and lost."
"So you are quite certain that John Aaron died of a sudden illness?"
"I am," Pycelle replied gravely. "If not illness, my good lord, what else could it be?"
"Poison?" Ned suggested quietly. Pycelle's sleepy eyes flicked open. The aged maester shifted uncomfortably in his seat.
"A disturbing thought. We are not the free cities where such things are common. Grand Maester Æthelmuir wrote that all men carry murder in their hearts, yet even so, the poisoner is beneath contempt."
He fell silent for a moment, his eyes lost in thought.
"What you suggest is possible, my lord, yet I do not think it likely. Every hedge maester knows the common poisons, and Lord Aaron displayed none of the signs. and the hand was loved by all. What sort of monster in man's flesh would dare to murder such a noble lord?
I've heard it said that poison is a woman's weapon. Pycelle stroked his beard thoughtfully.
It is said, women, cravens, and eunuchs.
He cleared his throat and spat a thick glob of phlegm onto the rushes. Above them, a raven cawed loudly in the rookery.
The Lord Varys was born a slave in Lice. Did you know? Put not your trust in spiders, my lord.
That was scarcely anything Ned needed to be told.
There was something about Varys that made his flesh crawl.
I will remember that, maester, and I thank you for your help. I've taken enough of your time. He stood. Grandmaster Pycelle pushed himself up from his chair slowly and escorted Ned to the door.
I hope I have helped in some small way to put your mind at ease. If there is any other service I might perform, you need only ask.
One thing, Ned told him. I should be very curious to examine the book that you lent John the day before he fell ill.
I fear you will find it of little interest, Pycelle said. It was a ponderous tome by Grand Maester Malian on the lineages of the great houses.
Still, I should like to see it. The old man opened the door.
As you wish. I have it here somewhere. When I find it, I shall have it sent to your chambers straight away.
You have been most courteous, Ned told him. Then, almost as an afterthought, he said, One last question, if you would be so kind. You mentioned that the king was at Lord Arryn's bedside when he died. I wonder, was the queen with him?
Why, no, Pycelle said. She and the children were making the journey to Casterly Rock in company with their father. Lord Tywin had brought a retinue to the city for the tourney on Prince Joffrey's name day, no doubt hoping to see his son Jaime win the champion's crown. In that he was sadly disappointed. It failed to me to send the queen word of Lord Arryn's sudden death. Never have I sent off a bird with a heavier heart.
Dark wings, dark words, Ned muttered. It was a proverb old Nan had taught him as a boy.
So the fishwives say,
Grand Maester Pycelle agreed.
But we know it is not always so. When Maester Lewin's bird brought the word about your Bran, the message lifted every true heart in the castle, did it not?
As you say, Maester.
The guards are merciful.
Pycelle bowed his head.
Come to me as often as you like, Lord Eddard. I am here to serve.
Yes, Ned thought, as the door swung shut. But whom? On the way back to his chambers, he came upon his daughter Arya on the winding steps of the Tower of the Hand, windmilling her arms as she struggled to balance on one leg. The rough stone had scuffed her bare feet. Ned stopped and looked at her. Arya? What are you doing?
Sirio says a water dancer can stand on one toe for hours. Her hands flailed at the air to steady herself. Ned had to smile.
Which toe? He teased.
Any toe,
Arya said, exasperated with the question. She hopped from her right leg to her left, swaying dangerously before she regained her balance.
Must you do your standing here? He asked. It's a long, hard fall down these steps.
Syria says a water dancer never falls. She lowered her leg to stand on 2 feet. Father, will Bran come and live with us now?
Not for a long time, sweet one, he told her. He needs to win his strength back.
Arya bit her lip. What will Bran do when he's of age?
Ned knelt beside her. He has years to find that answer, Arya. For now it is enough to know that he will live. The night the bird had come from Winterfell, Eddard Stark had taken the girls to the castle Godswood, An acre of elm and alder and black cottonwood overlooking the river. The heart tree there was a great oak, its ancient limbs overgrown with smokeberry vines. They knelt before it to offer their thanksgiving, as if it had been a weirwood. Sansa drifted to sleep as the moon rose. Arya, several hours later, curling up in the grass under Ned's cloak. All through the dark hours he kept his vigil alone. When dawn broke over the city, the dark red blooms of dragon's breath surrounded the girls where they lay. "I dreamt of Bran," Sansa had whispered to him. "I saw him smiling." "He was going to be a knight," Arya was saying now, "a knight of the King's Guard. Can he still be a knight?" "No," Ned said. He saw no use in lying to her. "Yet some day he may be the lord of a great holdfast and sit on the King's Council. He might raise castles like Brandon the Builder, or sail a ship across the Sunset Sea, or enter your mother's faith and become the High Septon. But he will never run beside his wolf again," he thought with a sadness too deep for words, "or lie with a woman, or hold his own son in his arms." Arya cocked her head to one side. "Can I be a king's counselor and build castles and become the High Septon?" "You," Ned said, kissing her lightly on the brow, "will marry a king and rule his castle, and your sons will be knights and princes and lords, and yes, perhaps even a High Septon." Arya screwed up her face. "Nah," she said, "that's Sansa." She folded up her right leg and resumed her balancing. Ned sighed and left her there. Inside his chambers, he stripped off his sweat-stained silks and sluiced cold water over his head from the basin beside the bed. Alan entered as he was drying his face. "My lord," he said, "Lord Baelish is without and begs audience." "Escort him to my Isola," Ned said, reaching for a fresh tunic, the lightest linen he could find. "I'll see him at once." Littlefinger was perched on the window seat when Ned entered, watching the knights of the King's Guard practice at swords in the yard below.
"If only old Selmy's mind was nimble as his blade," he said wistfully, "our council meetings would be a great deal livelier."
"Sir Barristan is as valiant and honourable as any man in the King's Landing." Ned had come to have a deep respect for the aged, white-haired Lord Commander of the King's Guard.
"And as tiresome," Littlefinger added, "though I dare say he should do well in the tourney. Last year he unhorsed the Hound, and it was only 4 years ago he was champion."
The question of who might win the tourney interested Eddard Stard not in the least. "Is there any reason for this visit, Lord Petar, or are you simply here to enjoy the view from my window?" Littlefinger smiled.
"I promised Cat I would help you in your inquiries, and so I have."
That took Ned aback. Promise or no promise, he could not find it in him to trust Lord Petar Baelish, who struck him as too clever by half. "You have something for me?"
"Someone," Littlefinger corrected. "Four someones, if truth be told. Had you thought to question the Hand's servants?"
Ned frowned. "Would that I could. Lady Arryn took her household back to the Eyrie. Lysa has done him no favour in that regard. All those who had stood closest to her husband had gone with her when she fled. John's maester, his steward, the captain of his guard, his knights and retainers."
"Most of her household," Littlefinger said. "Not all. A few remain. A pregnant kitchen girl, hastily wed to one of Lord Renly's grooms, a stable hand who joined the city watch, a potboy discharged from service for theft, and Lord Arryn's squire."
"His squire?" Ned was pleasantly surprised. A man's squire often knew a great deal of his comings and goings.
"Sir Hugh of the Vale," Littlefinger named him. "The king knighted the boy after Lord Arryn's death."
"I shall send for him," Ned said, "and the others." Littlefinger winced.
My lord, step over here to the window, if you will be so kind.
Why?
Come, and I'll show you, my lord.
Frowning, Ned crossed to the window. Pataia Baelish made a casual gesture.
There, across the yard, at the door of the armory, do you see the boy squatting by the steps honing a sword with an oilstone?
What of him?
He reports to Varys. The spider has taken a great interest in you and all your doings.
He shifted in the window seat.
Now glance at the wall farther west, above the stables. The guardsman leaning on the ramparts?
Ned saw the man. Another of the eunuch's whisperers?
No, this one belongs to the queen. Notice that he enjoys a fine view of the door to this tower, the better to note who calls on you. There are others, many unknown even to me. The Red Keep is full of eyes. Why do you think I hid Cat in a brothel?
Eddard Stark had no taste for these intrigues. Seven hells, he swore. It did seem as though the man on the walls was watching him. Suddenly uncomfortable, Ned moved away from the window. Is everyone someone's informer in this cursed city?
Scarcely, said Littlefinger.
He counted on the fingers of his hand.
Why, there's me, you, the king. Although, come to think of it, the king tells the queen much too much, and I'm less than certain about you.
He stood up.
Is there a man in your service that you trust utterly and completely?
Yes, said Ned.
Oh, in that case, I have a delightful palace in Valeria I would dearly love to sell you.
Littlefinger said with a mocking smile.
The wiser answer was no, my lord. But be that as it may, send this paragon of yours to Sir Hugh and the others. Your own comings and goings will be noted, but even Varys the Spider cannot watch every man in your service every hour of the day.
He started for the door. Lord Pataia, Ned called after him, I am grateful for your help. Perhaps I was wrong to distrust you. Littlefinger fingered his small pointed beard.
You are slow to learn, Lord Eddard. Distrusting me was the wisest thing you've done since you climbed down off your horse.
The Windblown. The word passed through the camp like a hot wind. She is coming. Her host is on the march. She is racing south to Yunkai to put the city to the torch and its people to the sword, and we are going north to meet her. Frog had it from Dick Straw, who had it from old Bill Bone, who had it from a Pentoshi named Miriam Maracus, who had a cousin who served as cupbearer to the tattered prince. Cos heard it in a command tent, from Kago's own lips, Dick Straw insisted. We'll march before the day's out, see if we don't. That much proved true. The command came down from the tattered prince, through his captains and his sergeants. Strike the tents, load the mules, saddle the horses. We march for Yunkai at the break of day. Not that them Yunkish bastards will be wanting us inside their yellow city, sniffing round their daughters, predicted back the squint-eyed Mirish bowman, whose name meant beans. We'll get provisions in Yunkai, maybe fresh horses, and then it will be on to Meereen to dance with a dragon queen. So hop quick, Frog, and put a nice edge on your master's sword. Might be he'll need it soon. In Dawn, Quentin Martell had been a prince, in Valantis a merchant's man, but on the shores of Slaver's Bay he was only Frog, squire to the big bold Dornish knight the sellswords called Greenguts. The men of the Windblown used what names they would, and changed them at a whim. They fastened Frog on him, because he hopped so fast when the big man shouted a command. Even the commander of the Windblown kept his true name to himself. Some free companies had been born during the century of blood and chaos that had followed the doom of Valyria. Others had been formed yesterday and would be gone upon the morrow. The Windblown went back 30 years, and had but one commander, the soft-spoken, sad-eyed, Pentoshi nobleman, called the Tattered Prince. His hair and mail were silver-grey, but his ragged cloak was made of twists of cloth of many colours, blue and grey and purple, red and gold and green, magenta and vermilion and cerulean, all faded by the sun. When the Tattered Prince was 23, as Dick Straw tells the story, the magisters of Pentos had chosen him to be their new prince, hours after beheading their old prince. Instead, he'd buckled on a sword, mounted his favourite horse, and fled to the disputed lands, never to return. He had ridden with the Second Sons, the Iron Shields, and the Maiden's Men, then joined with 5 brothers-in-arms to form the Windblown. Of those 6 founders, only he survived. Frug had no notion whether any of that was true. Since signing into the Windblown in Volantis, he had seen the Tattered Prince only at a distance. The Dornish men were new hands, raw recruits, arrow fodder, 3 amongst 2,000. Their commander kept more elevated company. "I am not a squire," Quentin had protested, when Gerris Drinkwater, known here as Dornish Geralt, to distinguish him from Geralt Redback and Black Geralt, and sometimes as Drink, since the big man had slipped and called him that, suggested the ruse. "I earned my spurs in Dorne. I am as much a knight as you are." But Gerris had the right of it. He and Arch were here to protect Quentin, and that meant keeping him by the big man's side. "Arch is the best fighter of the 3 of us," Drinkwater had pointed out, "but only you can hope to wed the Dragon Queen." "Wed her or fight her, either way, I will face her soon." The more Quentin heard of Daenerys Targaryen, the more he feared that meeting. The Yunkai claimed that she fed her dragons on human flesh and bathed in the blood of virgins to keep her skin smooth and supple. Beans laughed at that, but relished the tales of the Silver Queen's promiscuity. "One of her captains comes of a line where the men have foot-long members," he told them. "But even he's not big enough for her. She rode with a Dothraki and grew accustomed to being fucked by stallions. So now no man can fill her." And Books, the clever Volantine swordsman, who always seemed to have his nose poked in some crumbly scroll, thought the Dragon Queen both murderous and mad. "Her cow killed her brother to make her queen. Then she killed her cow to make herself Khaleesi. She practices blood sacrifice, lies as easily as she breathes, turns against her own on a whim. She's broken truces, tortured envoys. Her father was mad too. It runs in the blood." It runs in the blood. King Aerys II had been mad. All of Westeros knew that. He had exiled 2 of his hands and burnt 1/3. "If Daenerys is as murderous as her father, must I still marry her?" Prince Doran had never spoken of that possibility. Frog would be glad to put Astapor behind him. The Red City was the closest thing to hell he ever hoped to know. The Yunkai had sealed the broken gates to keep the dead and dying inside the city. But the sights that he had seen riding down those red brick streets would haunt Quentin Martell forever. A river choked with corpses, the priestess in her torn robes impaled upon a stake and attended by a cloud of glistening green flies. Dying men staggering through the streets, bloody and befouled. Children fighting over half-cooked puppies. The last free king of Astapor screaming naked in the pit as he was set upon by 10 of starving dogs. And fires, fires everywhere. He could close his eyes and see them still. Flames whirling from brick pyramids larger than any castle he'd ever seen. Plumes of greasy smoke coiling upward like great black snakes. When the wind blew from the south, the air smelled of smoke even here, 3 miles from the city. Behind its crumbling red brick walls, Astapor was still a smoulder. though by now most of the great fires had burned out. Ashes floated lazily on the breeze like fat grey snowflakes. It would be good to go. The big man agreed.
"Past time,"
he said, when Frog found him dicing with beans and books and old Bill Bone, and losing it again. The sellswords loved Green Guts, who bet as fearlessly as he fought, but with far less success.
"I want my armor, Frog. Did you scrub that blood off my mail?"
"Aye, sir." Green Guts's mail was old and heavy, patched and patched again, much worn. The same was true of his helm, his gorget, greaves, and gauntlets, and the rest of his mismatched plate. Frog's kit was only slightly better, and Sir Gerus's was notably worse.
"Company steel," the armourer had called it.
Quentin had not asked how many other men had worn it before him, how many men had died in it. They had abandoned their own fine armour in Valentus, along with their gold and their true names. Wealthy knights from houses old in honour did not cross the narrow sea to sell their swords, unless exiled for some infamy.
"I'd sooner pose as poor than evil," Quentin had declared, when Gerus had explained his ruse to them.
It took the windblown less than an hour to strike their camp.
"And now we ride,"
the tattered prince proclaimed from his huge grey war horse, in a classic High Valyrian that was the closest thing they had to a company tongue. His stallion's spotted hindquarters were covered with ragged strips of cloth torn from the surcoats of men his master had slain. The prince's cloak was sewn together for more of the same. An old man he was, past 60, yet he still sat straight and tall in the high saddle, and his voice was strong enough to carry to every corner of the field.
"Master Poor, was but a taste," he said. "Meereen will be the feast."
And the sellswords sent up a wild cheer. Streamers of pale blue silk fluttered from their lances, whilst fork-tailed blue and white banners flew overhead, the standards of the windblown. The three Dornish men cheered with all the rest. Silence would have drawn notice. But as the windblown rode north along the coast road, close behind Bloodbeard and the company of the cat, Frog fell in beside Dornish Geralt. "Soon," he said, in the common tongue of Westeros. There were other Westerosi in the company, but not many, and not near.
"We need to do it soon."
"Not here,"
warned Gerus, with a mummer's empty smile.
"We'll speak of this tonight, when we make camp."
It was 100 leagues from Astabor to Yunkai, by the old Gascari coast road, and another 50 from Yunkai to Meereen. The free companies, well mounted, could reach Yunkai in 6 days of hard riding, or 8 at a more leisurely pace. The legions from Old Gis would take half again as long, marching afoot, and the Yunkai and their slave soldiers,
"With their generals, it's a wonder they don't march into the sea," Bean said.
The Yunkai did not lack for commanders. An old hero named Yerkazo Yunsak had the supreme command, though the men of the windblown glimpsed him only at a distance, coming and going in a palanquin so huge it required 40 slaves to carry it. They could not help but see his underlings, however. The Yunkish lordlings scuttled everywhere, like roaches. Half of them seemed to be named Gazdan, Grazdan, Mazdan, or Gaznak. Telling one Gascari name from another was an art few of the windblown had mastered, so they gave them mocking styles of their own devising. Foremost amongst them was the Yellow Whale, an obscenely fat man who always wore yellow silk tokars with golden fringes. Too heavy even to stand unassisted, he could not hold his water, so he always smelled of piss, a stench so sharp that even heavy perfumes could not conceal it. But he was said to be the richest man in Yunkai, and he had a passion for grotesques. His slaves included a boy with the legs and hooves of a goat, a bearded woman, a two-headed monster for Mantares, and a hermaphrodite who warmed his bed at night. Cuck and Connie both, Dick Straw told them. The whale used to own a giant, too. Liked to watch him fuck his slave girls. Then he died. I hear the whale, they'd give a sack of gold for a new one. Then there was the girl general, who rode about on a white horse with a red mane and commanded 100 strapping slave soldiers that she had bred and trained herself, all of them young, lean, rippling with muscle, and naked but for breech clouts, yellow cloaks, and long bronze shields with erotic inlays. Their mistress could not have been more than 16, and fancied herself Yunkai's own Daenerys Targaryen. The little pigeon was not quite a dwarf, but he might have passed for one in a bad light. Yet he strutted about as if he were a giant, with his plump little legs spread wide and his plump little chest puffed out. His soldiers were the tallest that any of the windblown had ever seen. The shortest stood 7 feet tall, the tallest close to 8. All were long-faced and long-legged, and the stilts built into the legs of their ornate armor made them longer still. Pink enamel scales covered their torsos. On their heads were perched elongated helms, complete with pointed steel beaks and crests of bobbing pink feathers. Each man wore a long, curved sword upon his hip, and each clasped a spear as tall as he was, with a leaf-shaped blade at either end. "The little pigeon breeds them," Dick Straw informed them. "He buys tall slaves from all over the world, mates the men to the women, and keeps the tallest offspring for the errands. One day he hopes to be able to dispense with the stilts. A few sessions on the wreck might speed along the process," suggested the big man. Garrus Drinkwater laughed. "A fearsome lot. Nothing scares me worse than stilt walkers in pink scales and feathers. If one was after me, I'd laugh so hard my bladder might let go." "Some say that errands are majestic," said old Bill Bone. "If your king eats frogs while standing on one leg..." "Errands are craven," the big man put in. "One time me and Drink and Cletus were hunting, and we came on these herrings wading in the shallows, feasting on tadpoles and small fish. They made a pretty sight, aye, but then a hawk passed overhead, and they all took to the wing, like they'd seen a dragon. Kicked up so much wind, it blew me off me horse, but Cletus knocked an arrow to his string and brought one down. Tasted like duck, but not so greasy."
Even the little pigeon and his herons paled beside the folly of the brothers the sellswords called the Clanker Lords. The last time the slave soldiers of Yunkai had faced the Dragon Queen's Unsullied, they'd broken and run. The Clanker Lords had devised a stratagem to prevent that. They chained their troops together in groups of 10, wrist to wrist and ankle to ankle.
"None of the poor bastards can run unless they all run," Dick Straw explained, laughing. "And if they do all run, they won't run very fast."
"They don't fucking march very fast either," observed Beans. "You can hear them clanking 10 leagues off." There were more, near as mad or worse. Lord Wobblecheeks, the Drunken Conqueror, the Beastmaster, Puddingface, the Rabbit, the Charioteer, the Perfumed Hero. Some had 20 soldiers, some 200, or 2,000, all slaves they had trained and equipped themselves. Everyone was wealthy, everyone was arrogant, and everyone was a captain and commander, answerable to no one but Yerkaz Zoyunsek, disdainful of mere sellswords, and prone to squabbles over precedents that were as endless as they were incomprehensible. In the time it took the windblown to ride 3 miles, the Yunkai had fallen 2.5 miles behind. "A pack of stinking yellow fools," Beans complained. "They still ain't managed to puzzle out why the Stone Crows and the Second Stones went over to the Dragon Queen."
"For gold, they believe," said Books. "Why do you think they're paying us so well?"
"Gold is sweet, But life is sweeter, said Beans. We were dancing with cripples at Astapor. Do you want to face real Unsolid with that lot on your side?
We fought the Unsolid at Astapor,
the big man said.
I said real Unsolid, hacking off some boy's stones with a butcher's cleaver and handing him a pointy hat. Don't make him Unsolid. That Dragon Queen's got the real item, the kind that don't break and run when you fart in their general direction.
Them and dragons too. Dickstraw glanced up at the sky, as if he thought the mere mention of dragons might be enough to bring them down upon the company.
Keep your sword sharp, boys. We'll have us a real fight soon.
A real fight, thought Frog. The words stuck in his craw. The fight beneath the walls of Astapor had seemed real enough to him, though he knew the sellswords felt otherwise. That was butchery, not battle, the warrior bard Denzo Dan had been heard to declare afterwards. Denzo was a captain and veteran of 100 battles. Frog's experience was limited to practice yard and tourney ground, so he did not think it was his place to dispute the verdict of such a seasoned warrior. It seemed like a battle when it first began, though. He remembered how his guts had clenched when he was kicked awake at dawn with a big man looming over him.
In your armor, slug a bit, he boomed. The butcher's coming out to give us battle. Up, unless you meet a bee's meat.
The butcher king is dead, Frog had protested sleepily. That was a story all of them had heard as they scrambled from the ships that had brought them from old Valantis. A second King Cleon had taken the crown and died in turn, supposedly, and now the Astapori were ruled by a whore and a mad barber whose followers were fighting with each other to control the city.
Maybe they lied, the big man had replied, or else this is some other butcher. Might be the first one to come back screaming from his tomb to kill some youngish men. Makes no bloody matter, Frog. Get your armor on.
The tent slept 10, and all of them had been on their feet by then, wriggling into breeches and boots, sliding long coats of ringmail down onto their shoulders, buckling breastplates, tightening the straps on greaves or van braces, grabbing for helms and shields and sword belts. Gerys, quick as ever, was the first one fully clad, Arch close behind him. Together they helped Quentin don his own harness. 300 yards away, Astapor's new Unsolid had been pouring through their gates and forming up in ranks beneath their city's crumbling red brick walls, dawn-like glinting off their spiked bronze helmets and the points of their long spears. The 3 Dornishmen spilled from the tent together to join the fighters sprinting for the horse lines. Battle. Quentin had trained with spear and sword and shield since he was old enough to walk. But that meant nothing now. Warrior, make me brave, Frog had prayed as drums beat in the distance. Boom, 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 boom. The big man pointed out the Butcher King to him, sitting stiff and tall upon an armored horse in a suit of copper scale that flashed brilliantly in the morning sun. He remembered Gerys sidling up close just before the fight began.
Stay close to Arch, whatever happens. Remember, you are the only one of us who can get the girl.
By then, the Astapori were advancing. Dead or alive, the Butcher King still took the wise masters unawares. The youngish men were still running about in fluttering tokars, trying to get their half-trained slave soldiers into some semblance of order as Unsolid spears came crashing through their siege lines. If not for their allies and their despised hirelings, they might well have been overwhelmed. But the Windblown and the Company of the Cat were a horse in minutes and came thundering down on the Astapori flanks, even as a legion from New Gis pushed through the Yunkish camp from the other side and met the Unsolid spear to spear and shield to shield. The rest was butchery, but this time it was the Butcher King on the wrong end of the cleaver.
Kago was the one who finally cut him down, fighting through the king's protectors on his monstrous warhorse and opening Cleon the Great from shoulder to hip with one blow of his curved Valyrian arrack. Frog did not see it, but those who did claimed Cleon's copper armor rent like silk, and from within came an awful stench and 100 wriggling grave worms. Cleon had been dead after all. The desperate Astapori had pulled him from his tomb, clapped him into armor, and tied him onto a horse in hopes of giving heart to their unsullied. Dead Cleon's fall wrote an end to that. The new unsullied threw down their spears and shields and ran, only to find the gates of Astapor shut behind them. Frog had done his part in the slaughter that followed, riding down the frightened eunuchs with the other windblown. Hard by the big man's hip he rode, slashing right and left as their wedge went through the unsullied like a spear point. When they burst through on the other side, the tattered prince had wheeled them round and led them through again. It was only coming back that Frog got a good look at the faces beneath the spiked bronze caps and realized that most were no older than he. Green boys screaming for their mothers, he thought, but he killed them all the same. By the time he'd left the field, his sword was running red with blood and his arm was so tired he could hardly lift it. Yet that was no real fight, he thought. The real fight will be on us soon, and we must be away before it comes, or we'll find ourselves fighting on the wrong side. That night, the windblown made camp beside the shore of Slaver's Bay. Frog drew the first watch and was sent to guard the horse lines. Garrus met him there just after sundown, as a half-moon shone upon the waters. "The big man should be here as well," said Quentin.
"He's gone to look up old Bill Bone and lose the rest of his silver," Garrus said. "Leave him out of this. He'll do as we say, though he won't like it much."
No. There was much and more about this Quentin did not like himself. Sailing on an overcrowded ship, tossed by wind and sea, eating hard bread, crawling with weevils, and drinking black tar rum to sweet oblivion, sleeping on piles of mouldy straw with a stench of strangers in his nostrils. All that he had expected when he made his mark on that scrap of parchment in Volantis, pledging the tattered prince his sword and service for a year. Those were hardships to be endured, the stuff of all adventures. But what must come next was plain betrayal. The Yunkai had brought them from old Volantis to fight for the Yellow City, but now the Dornishmen meant to turn their cloaks and go over to the other side. That meant abandoning their new brothers-in-arms as well. The Windblown were not the sort of companions Quentin would have chosen, but he had crossed the sea with them, shared their meat and mead, fought beside them, traded tales with those few whose talk he understood. And if all his tales were lies, well, that was the cost of passage to Meereen. "It is not what you call honourable," Garrus had warned them back at the merchant's house. "Daenerys may be halfway to Yunkai by now, with an army at her back," Quentin said as they walked amongst the horses. "She may be," Garrus said, "but she's not. We've heard such talk before. The Astapori were convinced Daenerys was coming south with her dragons to break the siege. She didn't come then, and she's not coming now. We can't know that, not for certain. We need to steal away before we end up fighting the woman I was sent to woo." "Wait till Yunkai," Garrus gestured at the hills. "These lands belong to the Yunkai. No one is like to want to feed or shelter three deserters. North of Yunkai, that's no man's land." He was not wrong, even so, Quentin felt uneasy. "The big man's made too many friends. He knows the plan was always to steal off and make our way to Daenerys, but he's not going to feel good about abandoning men he's fought with. If we wait too long, it's going to feel as if we're deserting them on the eve of battle. He will never do that. You know him as well as I do."
"It's desertion, whenever we do it,"
our good Geras. And the tattered prince takes a dim view of deserters. He'll send hunters after us, and seven savers if they catch us. If we're lucky, they'll just chop off a foot to make sure we never run again. If we're unlucky, they'll give us to Pretty Meris. That last gave Quentin pause. Pretty Meris frightened him. A Westerosi woman, but taller than he was, just a thumb under 6 feet. After 20 years amongst the free companies, there was nothing pretty about her, inside or out. Geras took him by the arm. Wait a few more days, that's all. We have crossed half the world. Be patient for a few more leagues. Somewhere north of Yankai, our chance will come. If you see, said Frog doubtfully. But for once the guards were listening, and their chance came much sooner than that. It was 2 days later. Hugh Hungerford reined up by their cook fire and said,
Dornish, you're wanted in the command tent.
Which one of us? Asked Geras. We're all Dornish.
All of you, then.
Sar and Saturnine, with a maimed hand, Hungerford had been company paymaster for a time, until the tattered prince had caught him stealing from the coffers and removed three of his fingers. Now he was just a sergeant.
What could this be?
Up to now, Frog had no notion that their commander knew he was alive. Hungerford had already ridden off, however, so there was no time for questions. All they could do was gather up the big man and report as ordered. Admit to nothing and be prepared to fight, Quentin told his friends.
I'm always prepared to fight, said the big man.
The great grey sailcloth pavilion that the tattered prince liked to call his canvas castle was crowded when the Dornishmen arrived. It took Quentin only a moment to realize that most of those assembled were from the Seven Kingdoms or boasted Westerosi blood. Exiles, or the sons of exiles. Dixtor claimed there were 60 Westerosi in the company. A good third of those were here, including Dick himself, Hugh Hungerford, Pretty Maris, and golden-haired Lewis Leinster, the company's best archer. Denzo Darn was there as well, with Kago huge beside him. Kago Corpse Killer, the men were calling him now, though not to his face. He was quick to anger, and that curved black sword of his was as nasty as its owner. There were hundreds of Valyrian longswords in the world, but only a handful of Valyrian Araks. Neither Kago nor Darn was Westerosi, but both were captains, and stood high in the tattered prince's regard. His right arm and his left. Something major is afoot. It was the tattered prince himself who did the speaking. Orders have come down from Yarkas, he said. What Astaporia still survive have come creeping from their hidey-holes, it seems. There's nothing left in Astapor but corpses. So they're pouring out into the countryside, hundreds of them, maybe thousands, all starved and sick. The Yunkai don't want them near their yellow city. We've been commanded to hunt them down and turn them, drive them back to Astapor or north to Meereen. If the Dragon Queen wants to take them in, she's welcome to them. Half of them have the bloody flux, and even the healthy ones are mouths to feed.
Yunkai is closer than Meereen,
Hugh Hungerford objected.
What if they won't turn, my lord?
That's why you have swords and lances, Hugh, though bows might serve you better. Stay well away from those who show signs of the flux. I'm sending half our strength into the hills. 50 patrols, 20 riders each. Bloodbeard's got the same orders, so the cats will be in the field as well. A look passed between the men, and a few muttered under their breath. Though the Windblown and the company of the cat were both under contract to Yunkai, a year ago in their disputed lands they had been on opposite sides of the battle lines, and bad blood still lingered. Bloodbeard, the savage commander of the cats, was a roaring giant with a ferocious appetite for slaughter, who made no secret of his disdain for old greybeards in rags. Dick Straw cleared his throat.
Begging your pardon, but we're all Seven Kingdoms born here. My lord never broke up the company by blood or tongue before. Why send us lot together?